Hi, this is Barry, and welcome to Simplicity Zen. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you could take a moment to subscribe, like the video, and hit the little alert button, I'd appreciate it. Of course, it makes me feel loved when people do it. But most importantly, the YouTube algorithm uses those metrics in figuring out how widely to share these videos. So if you do that, it'll help more people see this. If it seems like over the last couple of months, a lot more people are consuming this content on the various podcast channels. If you're listening on that, you can subscribe through the podcast player that you're listening on, or you can go to simplicityzen.com and sign up for the newsletter there. And also my contact information is there. I enjoy hearing from people about these podcasts. So if you want to reach out to me, I would definitely welcome that. Today, my guest is Mark Doyle Album, also known as Yusan. Mark was a longtime student of the legendary Rinzai Zen master, Shoto Harada Roshi, in Japan. After a long period of monastic practice, over 15 years, he's now practicing as a shiatsu therapist, a meditation guide, mentor, and translator. Mark lives in southern Germany. Thanks so much for joining us today, Mark.
Pleasure, Barry.
Yeah. So could you tell us, before we dive in kind of to the narrative of your practice, could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now? So your practice is based in southern Germany. Kind of what's your day-to-day touch points with practice at this point in your life?
Oh, well, it's just day-to-day. You know, yeah. I don't do a formal Zen practice. I haven't done a session for 19 years. Mm-hmm. But the sitting issue has stayed with me, and I've done a lot of Qigong. I picked it up actually in Sogenji. Mm-hmm. She had us doing Tai Chi, and he pulled me into his room because I was so stiff, and actually let me do Qigong with him for a few months at the end of the evening. And So that stuck with me. I've been doing that for many years now, the Tai Chi, the Qigong. And I teach sometimes that, or if I give a course, I add some Qigong to it, for sure. But that's daily. And I didn't think I had it, but I have a Shakuhachi. I have three Shakuhachis, actually. So Zen music kind of includes, you know, a lot of breathing and connecting and getting in your center in shape. So that's also part of what I do daily, hopefully daily. And the shiatsu practice, which is also, I studied with a Japanese, also with a very strong tandem, with kind of a Masanaga line guy with very strong connection to centering the tandem, and also connected to Rinzai Zen. He also knew Taizu Roshi quite well. Who is the older Dharma brother of Harada Roshi. So I've just been around that stuff. And so everything I do seems to stay a little connected to it in my daily life. And I met my wife at a shiatsu Zen seminar. Had me do and hit everybody with the keisaku. So I gave her a good thwack, and that's actually how we met. I kind of asked her how her shoulders were feeling afterwards, and that was our first conversation. So every day. But she's pretty much taken over the Roshi position at the moment.
So I'm going to tell you my full extent of my knowledge about shiatsu. It's some sort of Japanese massage. There's some filling in the blanks that would help. Like, can you tell us what shiatsu is and maybe kind of how it relates to your experiences in and so forth? Sure. If at all.
Sure. It originates from two directions. One direction is the sort of household Japanese chiropractic, you know, where they just dug you got pain in your back. They just stuck their thumb in there. I met a few guys who like to do that, just get their thumbs in there. You know, you know, the Seitai, all the little techniques that people develop, the home remedies for working with qi in the body, which the Japanese naturally developed, were a big part of the original shiatsu idea, but then got mixed with the sense of qi and energy and TCM. So a famous shiatsu practitioner in the 50s, 60s, 70s named Masunaga combined the meridian system. He actually relocated meridians that have existed in the Chinese system for thousands of years and had the idea that you can actually find each of the meridians, main meridians, in both the upper and lower and front and back parts of the body. So you can basically treat anybody in any posture. You can treat their organ system. Mm-hmm. So you learn the meridians, you learn traditional Chinese medicine basics, you study the Yellow Emperor in our school. If you do it this kind of shiatsu, there are other forms of shiatsu that are not as interested in traditional Chinese medicine, but I got a good base in that as well. And the basic, most important thing is the touch. So if you can really center, you don't really have to do much. There's so much information coming through your hands, and with your own breath and your sense of energy, you can then sort of work with how much. The principle, I would say, is if you find a weak spot, you give energy. And if you find a tense spot, you sedate that energy. And mm-hmm. so by connecting, you can sort of navigate that, right? You can give, lean in, you know, mm-hmm. but not with your shoulders, hopefully with your arms as much. More with your tanden in your center, and that energy then becomes kind of a chi relationship with the client.
So it sounds like, and maybe this is a naive term, because I don't know a lot about massage, but it sounds like it's just a deep tissue type massage where you're really getting into the muscles. Is that in organs? Is that correct?
Can be. I mean, that's certainly a great aspect of shiatsu. You can really get in there, and if you know, it's like if you hit somebody on the shoulder like this, it hurts. But if you start slowly and you lean in gradually, you can go very, very deep. And the person might notice that, oh, that's going in there. But it's not the same pain, and they can take it. And maybe that, you know, it's like knocking on the door of kind of a place, and you know, somebody has to get in there and knock on that door. Mm-hmm. So that it opens up, someone opens that door up, and that energy can move in. Some fresh air, some fresh energy can move into that space, right? Mm-hmm. And can be deep tissue, but it can be very on the surface as well. A lot of people are very sensitive. You can just barely touch them, and you know, but you can do a lot once you get, you know, a little bit into the sensitivity of it. Touch has an amazing effect. You don't have to go do deep tissue. You can. Mm-hmm. Just touch the right place at the right time. You can help. You can support.
Sounds very intuitive and interactive.
In the way I think you have to find that. It can be very rigid when you learn it, because there are systems, and you want to learn the meridians. You want to learn certain steady things so you feel secure. I mean, you're touching a person's body. You want to have a rhythm and a system to work with. So at the beginning, I would say it's also not just intuitive. And I started that way originally. I just put my hands on and was helping people. But at some point, I needed a system and something more to go with if I was going to have more stamina with it and not just kind of expect that something good's going to happen every time I put my hands and kind of move. But it's kind of goes full circle. At some point, when you work with people, you do a lot more of that. You start to move very intuitively, and sometimes it can be just like it was for me at the very beginning when I didn't know anything.
It kind of, when you're saying that, it kind of made me think of both kind of fine art and music, where you gotta learn the basics before you can improvise effectively. You know, first you learn the scales and harmonic structure and, you know, music theory, or you have to learn the, you know, basics of composition and the technical skills of art. And then once you've kind of mastered those, then you can kind of go off the reservation. So it kind of sounds a little similar in that respect, maybe.
Well, sure. I mean, that's going to open up more space for you. If you have given a certain, devotion to the basics, that's going to fall into that intuitive movement, you know, and there are reasons why those basics are there, sure. So, they give you a base to move from, so you can help more people, and you have more information guides, right? But working with that information, sure, you can get stuck to the form. You can just do the same thing every time. You know, it's like sitting. It's not always just fantastic, inspirational encounters. You know, it gets better and better. I have to admit, though, I'm having more and more joy in it. So,
Yeah. When you sit these days, are you just kind of following the breath, or more kind of open awareness? Like, what is your practice these days?
Oh, I'm very free with myself. I like to use voice, you know, so I'll chant the Heart Sutra sometimes, just to feel that. I do generally spend some time just sitting in silence, where I do not make any effort to do anything, which is an effort in itself. But I'm, you know, hanging out then and listening, and that's fundamental every day. I do that with my wife every day. And then when I want to sit, you know, I mean, it really depends on, you know, if I want some power, you know, I focus on Tanden. If a client is coming, I can say their name and sit with them in my center. You know, if I feel, my energy's, how can I say, a little bit, yeah, if I'm not feeling, if I feel there's a strong emotion, just try to be with that. You know, I don't have a time limit, and I don't have a bell. If I sit with others, I teach Susokan. And, you know, sometimes I'll talk about Mu or something. And sure, once in a while, if I really need a shout, you know, like I'm in the car and I just have to, you know, get all that, you know, as a social worker for 17 years. Sometimes you just want to, you know, you want to give a good shout out. That's also okay. I can do that too. But I don't, I don't have a memory attached to how I'm practicing right now all the time. I have a lot of tools if I want to practice.
Yeah. So you grew up in Southern California, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, but I detect a slight accent. Is that German, or what is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I went from California to Japan, and I wanted to teach English. I went on a one-way ticket to Japan when I was 22 and just read a book called Jobs in Japan. And it was a kind of a black market deal, but it was 1985. But I just went and got jobs. Mm-hmm. But they didn't understand me very well. I was kind of a slang kind of California, you know, and my mom always told me I mumbled, but I really believed when the Japanese told me I mumbled.
So. We're like, dude, let me teach you English.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a guy recently, I had to fly over Minnesota and I got my first shoe shine in a long time. And this guy said, "Hey man, you talking funny. You talking real funny. You know, man, you got to come back home. You got to learn to talk English." And, you know, so I think it's relative. I don't speak English with very many native English speakers. You know, I've been to India quite a bit. I'm usually the only one. Everyone speaks English, and I'm usually the only one who was raised in an English-speaking place. So I have to speak English that other people understand, not just hometown English. When I start talking to my buddies when I come home for a week or so, I think it starts to be pretty California.
Where are your parents from?
L.A. area.
L.A. Uh-huh. Yeah, and then so you're born and raised in LA,
Orange County. They moved out to Orange County area for my high school, and then I went to UCLA. Right.
Mm-hmm. And how accurate would Spicoli from Fast Time at Ridgemont High, is that kind of your teenage years? Did you ever see that movie?
I did, but I would say, you know, there's this original Orange County movie with like Jack Black, and you know, it's sort of this, isn't it Jack? I think that's it. Anyways, I watched it, and it's about this guy who's going to the university, and none of his buddies want him to go. Yeah. And so in the end, I think he comes back and says, I'm going to stay in Orange County. I was the opposite. I was like, get me out of here.
I'm ready to go. I was in Southern California. I think I'm guessing we're similar age, and I was in Southern California for my teenage years, and I think at the time I think we thought we were like Spicoli, but I think really we were like Beavis and Butthead,
I had a pretty much what all Europeans at least think it would be so great to experience, you know, being in Newport Beach and being on the back of a motorcycle with your buddies and. You know, having lots of parties and all the stuff going on. I played baseball. So I kind of saved me. And I got decent grades because I knew that was going to save me from being stuck in all that forever. But my doubt developed already at that time. So something had to move out of all of that. It was fun, you know, but inside I wasn't close to being a happy person.
Yeah. Did you get involved in like beach or skateboard culture at all? Or were you more kind of on the jock?
I really surfed. No, I was kind of an inlander. I moved a little late to the beach areas, and then, you know, it was a little homey kind of thing. If you couldn't just show up without having to go through a little initiation of getting a hard time, which I wasn't really willing to also get up early for. So no, I kind of made my social climate through my sports and baseball. Spent a lot of time with friends at the beach throwing a frisbee, but not you know, body surfing and what we all did, you know, partying at the beach.
Did you so you mentioned like you're kind of already kind of had a doubt brewing at that point. What do you think you're, what was the doubt? Like what was your dilemma that was kind of gnawing at you?
Well, I mean, I think I wish I had, you know, I've been doing social work now 17 years after the monastery. So I've seen a lot of families. So I kind of know where it came from the family stuff. You know, there was a divorce at 12 years old, which caused the move. And I had been like ASB vice president. I got the drama award, and I was a photographer. I was the actor in all the school plays, and was the most valuable player on my basketball team, and had almost hit 500 as a baseball player. And at ninth grade at the junior high school, but then we moved and just with my mom, and I became kind of introvert. In the next high school, only baseball was the only thing I continued, and I worked in the library quite a bit. Started reading quite a bit of. I started reading quite a bit, and I think that kind of got me started on a different path. Right, I started reading Krishnamurti actually in high school, and a buddy of mine. Yeah, it's kind of a funny story, but. A buddy of mine, his father had a daughter at the Krishnamurti school in Ojai. So I got invited to go see Krishnamurti when I was 16 or 17 in Ojai. And that was, if I didn't have a clear doubt then it really started, right? Because there was this very beautiful, very silent human being. And it was obvious that he was just a human being. And shorter than me and didn't speak as good of English as I did, you know. But as soon as he was gone from the Ojai Valley, all that stuff came back. And then I knew I wanted to go back to this feeling I had in the Ojai Valley sitting there with Krishnamurti.
Is it kind of a sense of spaciousness? And
It was very deep silence, such clarity, such compassion for the collective society of the world, such clear words about nationalism. You know, that was a time of Reagan being reelected, and you know, there was a very strong, idea about having the draft come back. And I had very strong feelings about, not very positive feelings about the United States at the time, mm-hmm. all kind of connected to my father to a certain degree psychologically, but I think in some ways, many ways justified. I just looked and thought, God, this is a card house. This is a card house. Mm-hmm. I can't believe everybody just wants to drive a nice car and get rich and go to a good college and live happily ever after. It's life's not like that. And the main reason I knew it, Barry, was because my brother was born with muscular dystrophy mm-hmm. and had a diagnosis of Duchenne, which meant he was going to die between 14 and 20, right? Mm-hmm. And he was the closest person to me. And I think, you know, that's something I didn't ever analyze until much, much later or observe. But obviously, if the closest person to you is not going to have a three-car garage, he died in the third year of law school at UCLA and was a straight-A student who had 160 IQ, was just a kind of a strong personality, a very determined person. And he didn't have that kind of, he lived very in the moment towards his goals, but he wasn't going for those kind of strange ideals. Mm-hmm. He wanted to help people and he loved human beings. And so I kind of knowing he was going to die though, and then experiencing his death at 22 was sure a bounce out of any belief in a happily ever after kind of Southern mm-hmm. California dream. I had more of the Hotel California idea of it very, very quickly. Right.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any experience with psychedelics during your teenage or college years?
Yeah, I would say that was actually pretty important. My 16th Christmas day, when I was 16 years old, we took my first time some magic mushrooms and mm-hmm. walked around the golf course in the middle of the night on a full moon, and I understood everything that in the universe that night. And sure, unfortunately, somebody had to listen to that. I hope he forgives me. But that was good. And then I tried it. You know, it never really reached that same consistent, clear, beautiful experience. But obviously, then I read The Doors of Perception, and my friends and I would think about John Lennon and all these experiences and listen to the Moody Blues and kind of see that influence on the music we were listening to, right? And but I had a very early intuition that for my mind and body, I didn't like this kind of being, they call in German ferngesteuert, you know, like this drug is deciding whether I'm in an ecstatic state or starting to feel a little depression. Mm-hmm. It's out of my hands. I didn't like that. So I wanted to find this natural mm-hmm. consistent state of openness and beauty that I touched on mm-hmm. In those few little early experiences. I tried most of the stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think those experiences motivated your reading and of Krishnamurti and other books like that?
Sure. Hermann Hesse wrote Journey to the East, and I don't think it confirmed them, of course. I knew there was just more, you mm-hmm. know. I knew there was just so much more, but I had remembered that Aldous Huxley, right? I had read The Doors of Perception, and I remembered him saying, you know, I had this helper thing from a very young age because I was always helping my brother. Mm-hmm. And I remember Aldous Huxley saying that he wanted to have this LSD when he died. And he talked about his experience, and I think what he felt was this purity and this clarity, but he felt no motivation to do anything for anybody. Mm-hmm. And that didn't totally work with me. I needed to feel I was going to change the world, change the society and be helpful. I don't know why, but mm-hmm. that was very deeply instilled in me. I wanted a collective revolution and not just my own experience. Mm-hmm.
So you were still in high school when your brother passed away?
No, I was in college.
You were in college. Did you go to college in Southern California as well?
I went to UCLA, right? He went to Cal State Fullerton.
What did you study in college?
I studied, it took me a while to decide. I studied history, but actually angled towards intellectual history. I wanted to study philosophy, but I actually found studying history, I could study kind of the philosophers in their time. So I had a much better time. And then I studied German. So I read a lot of German literature and yeah, the connective philosophy. I had a 10-week course only on Goethe, and each week we had to read a whole Goethe work and talk about it in a seminar class. So I was very involved in European intellectual history. I actually applied to grad school for that.
So you got your bachelor's?
Yeah, sure. I went to Göttingen. I went to Germany for a year of study. I actually took my first student loan and bolted for a quarter. Went to the Matterhorn. I was sure everything was going to be better if I got to the Matterhorn. I don't know where I got that idea, but I went with a friend and discovered how cold it was in Switzerland in February. So I went back kind of with my a little bit more humble and decided I'm going to learn a language and go on an exchange program because the students that I had seen, you know, traveling around as an American, you just end up in Irish bars and youth hostels and trying to save money and meeting other travelers. And I saw the students and they had just a totally different vibe. They were relaxed. They were at more, much more at home in Europe and could just sit and observe a little more. And I wanted that. So I came back, learned German in college and was able to go for a year.
Like
And that
year
was great.
abroad type of thing?
Excuse me?
Like junior year abroad type of thing?
Yeah, it was my fourth year because I took that one quarter off, but I got my four quarters of German in, which didn't seem to help much at the beginning, but it got me on the program. So then I could go to Göttingen, which is the city that I studied in, and studied my butt off and learned to read and speak German pretty well, and traveled 5 months and went to a lot of the East Bloc countries because I had a kind of I kind of was into communism. I kind of was very, at that time, very anti-capitalist, and investigated for myself Czechoslovakia at that time and Poland and East Berlin and Yugoslavia and got a lot of travels in as well at that time. Other countries as well. Partied well. I partied in Greece too. It wasn't just an intellectual, but I was very, very much in my intellectual mode at that time.
In college, would you so it sounded like in your younger teenage years, you were kind of an extroverted, goal-oriented, and then kind of your later high school years, you're more introverted. Was college a mix of that, or were you going back into the extroverted?
No, I guess that's well said. Yes, it was both. I carried both over. I studied quite a bit. But I was also in a fraternity and partied and played sports and had a good time for the first 2 years. So I really felt also kind of a split personality in that way. I remember once there was a Ravi Shankar concert at the, you know, Royce Hall there in UCLA, and there was also like a sorority fraternity event, and I really couldn't decide what to do, what part of myself to emphasize that night. I remember just having no idea what to do, kind of waiting around to figure it out, you know.
So which one did you choose?
The girls.
So did you play ball in college for UCLA?
No, I was the last person to get cut. Mike Gallega was one of the infielders. They had so many good infielders that year, and Shane Mack and all these studs. They were good, but the coach was very kind. He put me up there the last try. I got to hit one last time at the last tryout game. It's a long story, actually. I blame my buddies why I didn't make the team, but the coach just said, "Hey, I have a lot of infielders on scholarship."
Yeah,
And
because I mean,
so
if you were
I.
hitting 500 at one point, even in high school, that's pretty good. Were you scouted or anything?
No, in junior high school, then in ninth grade, I hit 500. But in high school, I fielded 1,000. I didn't make an error at third base my senior year, which was good, but my hitting suffered. I started as a number 5 in the lineup, but I ended up at number 8 and 25. Wasn't so great. I don't know.
Yeah.
I got distracted.
Yeah.
I think I wasn't ready to give it all to baseball. I had already kind of started something else was happening, but still, I love baseball. My father played baseball. His father played baseball. My brother was always a scorekeeper for my teams. It was very much part of culture.
Do you still watch? Do you still follow it all?
Yordan Alvarez just blasted a 3-run homer for the Astros yesterday.
So are you a Dodgers or Angels person?
I went to I had season tickets to the Angel games for many years with my father as a kid. I kind of root for them, but that doesn't go anywhere. So I kind of root against the Dodgers.
Right.
I don't know why. Just an old habit from childhood.
Well, they're horrible. So they're evil. Just kidding. I like the San Francisco Giants. So I'm kind of.
Houston. I think Houston is kind of fun to watch, but I don't know why. I just find teams I like the, you know, when you're a kid and you, the first team that wins the World Series, and for me, it was the Detroit Tigers, 1968. So I always liked the Detroit Tigers for a long time, just because, and then the 69 Mets, I mean, that was amazing. I was living on the East Coast at the time. So as a kid, you're just like, your first baseball games on TV is the Mets winning the World Series, you know, come from behind kids or whatever they're called there. So anyways, I was, very much into that. My father knew a lot of the baseball players. He was a very good, he was a semi-pro player, and he broke his hand. He was hitting cleanup for UCLA. He broke his hand, and we used to go down to the field and meet some of the players that he would, at batting practice and stuff. So yeah, I was into baseball. Yeah.
Cool. So after you graduated, did you go directly to Japan to study, to teach English, or was there a layover period there?
No, that was my graduation present, was the ticket. A lot of things happened to make it work. My car got stolen and I got the insurance money for that. That was cool. No, I came back from Germany absolutely determined not to stay in Los Angeles. I got into the history program in graduate school at UCLA, but I had applied at Berkeley and didn't get in. And so I found this book called Jobs in Japan. I worked at an office on the university campus, and I found this book. I was helping people who wanted to do a year abroad find their program. And I found my program, which was to teach English in Japan, illegally, but legally.
So why Japan, of all places? Did you already have some sort of awareness of it through movies or reading?
Sure. There's a side story from Krishnamurti. I read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance in a college class. My required English class, I had to do 10 weeks Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and write a long paper about Zen in America. Mm-hmm. And then Zen Master Rama I don't know if you remember him. He was kind of a guy who floated around the esoteric scene in Southern California in the 80s.
But he was like not legit, if I remember right.
There was some pretty funky energy there, but he was encouraging people to make a lot of money and had a very different take on thing. Frederick Lenz or something like that was his name actually. But he had some mystical powers. I mean, I could feel it in the room. Like I could feel my knees different. Mm-hmm. But he was sure just recruiting people for his things. He wasn't in a tradition. He said it was through his different lifetimes that he's now appeared as Zen Master Rama from the flyer. But it was just something to see in a chemistry, lecture hall on the campus. And then I went to the LA Zen Center my last year.
Oh, you did?
I went at, it was the Zazenkai, my initial I had started reading a couple other books, and then I went to the Zen Center, but I got there at 1 minute after eight, and I said to myself, oh, too late, and I was just scared, and I drove away, and then I was mad at myself and came back 2 weeks later and joined the Zazenkai, which was only me and the guy who was meeting any newcomers. Mm-hmm. Super cool guy. We sat for a few minutes. He asked me also if I'd ever taken psychedelics. Mm-hmm. He had beautiful eyes. We drank some coffee with honey in it. And I was like, ah, this club is pretty cool. And then I came to another Sangha meeting with Maizumi Roshi. So I saw Maizumi Roshi, mm-hmm. and that was very good. I felt.
Is this in college?
This was still at the end of college, right?
Yeah.
And then I knew I liked him, but I didn't like this. I didn't like seeing all the Californians talking in the language, which mixed so much psychology and, I don't know, sort of sentimentalism with what I thought I wanted, Japanese Zen, which I got this idea from D.T. Suzuki, you know, reading a lot of the books that I had started doing. So I wanted to go to Japan and check it out, but I thought I would earn money teaching English for 2 years and then go on to India and China. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see the world for 3 years. That was my idea. Mm-hmm. But
Were you sitting at all in college, like any sort of meditation practice?
Sure. I started hiding out in different little, it was very scary for me. I felt like I was the only one at that period of American history. I felt like I was the only one interested in meditation at the time. Everybody was wearing alligator shirts, I thought, and I felt very much outnumbered. I mean, when I graduated, I think Reagan got reelected like 90%, and just, I felt the whole culture was against me, and I felt very, so I would hide out and count my breath. I read a couple more books from people who had studied at Tassajara, about breathing. And I just kept coming back to D.T. Suzuki and trying to understand that. And I was poking around Zen.
Mm-hmm. Did you also read Three Pillars of Zen? Was that one of the...
Not until I went to Japan and actually inside the... In Sogenji later. I didn't have any sense of Three Pillars of Zen. There was no... Mm-hmm. I came very much through the academic angle. Didn't have any Western Zen understanding. I hadn't met the people at all.
So it sounds like your motivation to go to Japan was at least partially Zen-oriented. You wanted to see if you could find some Zen practice there?
Sure. I mean, Kyoto and seeing the temples. And this friend of mine, whose father was a very famous, actually, Japanese modern artist named Sueo Serizawa. Mm-hmm. He and I got to know Sueo a little bit. And they had they would lead tours through Daitokuji. And they knew the priest at Shinju-an, which was the Ikkyu temple. Mm-hmm. Daitokuji, and they wrote me in a letter of introduction. So that was one thing I had.
You knew them from America, or?
Excuse me?
Did you know them from America or someone you met?
Yeah, my friend, the Japanese painter, he was living in Southern California.
Oh, cool.
He was my friend's stepfather, so I saw him quite often. And cool. So that's why he wrote me the letter, just to be friendly. And I had another letter of introduction to monks. My sister, in her law firm, met a woman who had stayed at a temple called Butsuji near Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. And this woman said I could stay there, and she wrote me also a letter of introduction, and I would eventually also write them and stay there after a year in Japan.
Mm-hmm. So when you went to Japan, did you start visiting temples and practicing right away, or is that something that came later?
No, I sure sat, you know, the first I got into yoga, everything I always wanted to do. I started doing yoga actually in my living room. It's funny, nowadays everyone's doing kind of their courses on the video, but I started yoga on television in 82 or 3 with Richard Hittleman. I don't know if you ever remember him, Yoga for Health. It was this
kind of, I guess that sounds familiar, yeah.
He's from the Bay Area, or his son he's passed now, but he just had these, you know, a Super 8 film, it seems like, and just very simple yoga postures. And, you know, I would watch the Maharishi and I would watch this yoga, these yoga things, and started doing it on the floor. So as soon as I got to Japan, I had a little yoga routine. And I remember, like, the fourth day, I got a little room, a little 4.5 tatami mat room with a paper closet. And I was doing one-legged posture, and I had my, you know, my foot in my hand, and it slipped out of my hand, and my foot flew, and I made a hole in a Japanese closet, which was like a wake up call to, like, things here are not like, you know, in California. I always had a big mirror, right, on my bedroom door. You know, it was just a big hard thing, and this was like boom
paper. So did you use your letters of introduction to go visit priests? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I went to Daitokuji and met the priest, and he gave me tea, and he was very kind. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say there was an immediate, like, good hit, but he took me to where you could do lay practice in Daitokuji, sort of the visitor's gaijin, you know, foreigner's center. And so I did that, and then I visited many temples in Kyoto. I was always in a temple doing the philosopher's walk. I worked at schools in Kyoto and Osaka, because the place I lived was right in between. So I was always just checking out the next temple and the next shrine and the next famous mountain or the next famous thing. Sure, the first 2 years I was there. And then I did go to Butsuji, which was a very important experience for me.
How did you communicate with people? Did they know English? Did you have rudimentary Japanese? Like, how did that work?
Well, at first I had to laugh, because I really was so handicapped not speaking any Japanese. I had gone to like 4 night school classes in Santa Monica. Didn't help. But I lived with a Japanese family that spoke no English, and I guess I picked up some words. And then I had a Japanese gal who, you know, semi-quasi-girlfriend, you know, kind of someone to hang out with, who you weren't sure where it was going. And we would sit in a coffee shop and go through the Nihon no Kiso, you know, the basic Japanese stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was picking it up fairly okay, I guess, for not knowing anything. I was picking up some words and was able to get around a little
bit. So, like, when you met the Roshi at Daitokuji, did you have an interpreter? Did he know English? Like, how did that work?
He spoke English. He spoke some English at that time. That was very early. That was just within the first week or two.
Oh, okay.
When I was there, right?
But how does that work? You have the letter. Do you just go up to the gate and be like, hey, read this letter, you know? Like, how does that actually, or do you make an appointment, or?
No, I think I, you know, you walk, you know, at that time, the temple is very small. And so you just gave the letter to an assistant, and then they gave the letter, and they made a half hour time or an hour time. I think he expected because my friend is an artist, he expected me to know a lot more about modern art. The priest was very interested in art, and I was just kind of, I'm here at the Ikkyu Temple. This is really cool. I didn't really have a lot to talk about.
So what was the name of the temple, the other temple you got an introduction to?
Butsuji.
Butsuji. So did you actually stay there and practice?
I did. That was very important. I went down. It's kind of a longer story. So I went down I finally, after a year and kind of, you know, working, I had to get a little money going to teaching English. I decided to finally take my first vacation, and I traveled. So I'd been there since October. So that was 1985, 1986. I went down in the summer. I went down towards Hiroshima, which was where the Butsuji is in the area. And on the way down, I would stop at different spots I thought would be interesting. And I chose Okayama. And when I got off, I found a brochure that told me about the famous gardens there. And I had already been playing the shakuhachi, so I wanted to play in these famous gardens, find a little corner to play my shakuhachi. I had a very romantic notion about that. So I went to Karakuen, which is the big garden, and that's the Yang garden. And the Yin garden was Sogenji. So I actually landed at Sogenji for no other reason than I was just traveling through and wanted to find a garden to play my flute in. And that's when Kansei-san, the old priest who was the Roshi, was taking care of and who had been already 33 years at that temple. Amazing guy. He was ordained when he was 9 and built many temples in China before the end of the war. He was a tea guy. And he was walking around with his dog, the lake, and he saw me and we sat down and talked, and he told me, however we communicated, that there were Americans there, that there was a very strong American woman translating for the master there and taking care of things. And I was kind of shocked. And then I heard this chanting going on. And then I heard some English coming from the temple. They were obviously having a meal. And then I heard this someone say, "Hey, there's a gaijin out there." And then someone else said, "Haven't you ever seen one before?" And I was so shocked, you know, to hear people talking the way I would talk, sort of human beings living in a temple. And that was like a real awakening to the fact that I could actually one day train also in a Zen temple. And as I walked out of the temple, I saw Nen-san, who's a blind nun who lived at Sogenji for many, many years. And I saw a white person. You know, she was kind of angelic. She had a shaved head, almost like an aura of an angel. But I kind of thought, shit, I could come back here. So that was on the way to Butsuji, right?
Butsuji, is that a Rinzai or Soto temple?
It's Rinzai. I think it's one of the 12, you know, lineages, but it was, I don't even know to what degree it still exists. It was really, really weak. There were only two monks living there at the time. I think there was an older priest or kind of a guiding older priest there, but I didn't see him much. It was a huge temple, really more, I think it was more like a monastery, a Soto. But there were only two monks there. It was an incredible place, really. And the first day I got there, I had written a letter, and they wrote very formally, "You can come for 1 week. Because this woman has written you this letter, you can come." And then I went, and they just had me. I really couldn't understand what those guys were talking about. And they had me clean and eat with them, and they just cooked like curry rice, and that was it. Same curry rice for 3-4 days. But in the Zendo, we sat three times a day for 25 to 45 minutes. And the first day I got there, the guy came, he grabbed my shoulders, the head monk, he put his knee there and he just pulled, you know, my back up straight. And it was like he left an imprint. And I sat like that and counted my breath but I had all this kind of psychological space because it was just one guy and me in the Zendo. And we couldn't speak, so there was nothing going in except life energy, right? And there was no food for thought. So there was a very, very powerful zazen energy in the Zendo.
Would those monks go do Dokusan with the Roshi, or was there any of that going on?
No, they seemed to be at their home temple just taking care of that big place. I don't know what else they were doing. I mean, they didn't, that was the thing, you know, it turned out that I felt very, like, there was this distance, right? Like I was in a Zen book or a Zen movie. I was just kind of moving around with them, but somehow didn't know how they were feeling me, right? They were just training me, like, whoa. And, you know, and finally, like, they just saw they wanted me to clean the floors. This place is huge. The wood floors are so long. But, you know, at some point, when the older monk, he just came and got me a mop because I didn't know how to through the floors, you know, right. Monks yeah. through the floor. I had no idea. I'm just like, okay, on my knees. And I couldn't be on my knees anyways at that time. So mm-hmm. it was just a silent experience with all these, with these three characters for 5 days. And I, they said I'd been there for a week, and then something happened. Yeah. On the fifth day, I was walking around these, the pagoda they have there, and there are all these hidden Buddhas in the garden around this pagoda, small mm-hmm. Buddha statues. And they're just, it was just such a discovery for me. They were so alive and so much a part of the landscape at the same time. And I don't know what happened. Something just changed within me. And then a young Western woman was visiting the temple, and we approached each other, and I said to her, and she asked me what I'm doing there in English. Mm-hmm. And I looked at her and I said, I'm living here. And the tone of voice I had was a resonance I had never heard before from me. Mm-hmm. And it felt so absolutely right. Mm-hmm. That I knew I had experienced, and I was feeling exactly what I wanted to know. I didn't notice anything those 4 days. I didn't think about my state of mind. I didn't observe it. It was only when I met this woman that I realized something had completely shifted within me. And then I just decided to leave 2 days before. I was ready. I knew that there was nothing more that I, in this period of time, for me to do in this situation. So I told them I'm leaving. And then the monk just looked at me and he started crying. He was so touched that we had been so obviously, for whatever reason, that we had been there, or that someone was there, or that, I don't know. He was a very sincere monk. I always wanted to go back and thank him that feeling.
So do you think you had a little opening there, or was it a little more subtle than that?
You know, there was no one to talk to. I was living on my own at the time, and I don't think I knew anyone who, everybody else wanted their own openings. If I knew anybody at the Kyoto Connection or something, you know, the foreigner community, I don't think I knew. I don't think I was ever, you know, I had had drugs before. I wasn't looking for, that was enough for me. That was more than enough. Sure, it was an opening, you know, sure it was incredible. I went down to Hiroshima to the museum, and it was so clear to me how the mind can just lose its center and then all this delusion happens. And I just walked through that museum so unemotionally and so clear. And I think that lasted about 10 days mm-hmm. where I had this very clear, I was walking very fast, and everywhere I went, I was just shh. But you know, I was forgetting things too. I locked myself out of my hotel room with the key inside. I left one of my bags on a train and never found it again. So I was always kind of going into this kind of mind state. And then I noticed I wasn't very good at bringing the world together with this. Yeah. And I remember when I came back to Osaka and I was in a phone booth, and I remember the moment that this sense of energy kind of went with some of the cars going by. I just remember it was kind of, it kind of left, and I was okay with that. I wasn't, I knew something in me kind of knew which direction to go, and that was made me very happy. So mm-hmm. I wasn't interested in holding on to it mm-hmm. for some reason. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what happened next? You were living in Japan still. So.
Yeah, right. I was teaching English, and I started studying Aikido because I was very cold. And the first year, very cold, and I decided I'm never going to go through that. But jogging in Japan was kind of weird, being a foreigner back then, and mm-hmm. so I got into Aikido kind of intensely again. I didn't read books about Aikido or the theory or anything, but it happened to be a pretty exceptional dojo with mm-hmm. Onsen Tanaka. He's one of was one of Ueshiba's disciples, and he was old by then, but his disciples had lived in the Aikido dojo for 10 years and mm-hmm. were such samurais. I mean, the chances of them understanding any English were really far away, but we communicated, and I went like 5 or 6 days a week for about a year mm-hmm. and got myself warm, took cold showers in the winter. I was totally determined to stay warm and not give in to that. So that was very intense. Mm-hmm. I learned something good was happening. Again, I didn't have any context for what was happening. I just developed a lot of Aikido energy, and then I started playing Shakuhachi, and I just was going for it. You know, I mean, I didn't have lots of culture, like foreigners around, a team of guys who were doing something similar. I was just kind of on my own, and all my friends doing it were older Japanese guys. There were a couple young Western guys around, but we weren't friends, at least not at that time. So that was very important, because I went to Europe with my roommate, a German guy, and we bought a car in Berlin and had the dream of driving all the way down to the south of Spain and back up through Paris and back to northern Germany and Berlin, and then selling the car in Japan and making tons of money buying an old German classic, a Karmann Ghia. We bought the car, did the trip, and the deal fell apart, of course, and so did my friendship with my friend. And I gained in those 2 months about 15 pounds. Mm-hmm. I had learned, I didn't understand how to keep my ki in my, I had got so wound around this Aikido, because mm-hmm. in the dojo there was no theory, it was just waza, 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 waza. And we were just doing it. And so when I went back, my Aikido teacher looked at me and just kind of went, you know, because I had gained this weight. And then I knew that I had also gotten really unhappy inside myself. I didn't like how I felt in my body, but I didn't know I liked so much how I felt in the ki state. So then I knew to keep this in my body, I needed to do something for 10 years. Kind of what was the result of that experience. And that's when I decided, I tried the Japanese teaching again, but I was so bored, and mm-hmm. I didn't really like modern Japanese society that much. And I mm-hmm. didn't think Japanese women were going to be my soulmates.
What did you not like about modern Japanese society? Just the work ethic, the focus on work?
Yeah. It was pretty intense time. I mean, they really, the Japanese were really going for it with the video games and sort of the neon, and they were rich, you know, was wealthy at that time. And I think everything they wanted was what I had experienced as a kid, you know, in California. You know, I had worked at the Playboy Mansion for a little while. I've been to Las Vegas and saw lots of shows, and mm-hmm. you know, did things as a kid, and it seemed like Japan was kind of going for that. I did like going to dinner, you know, and eating the food and having some drinks, and I did enjoy the people actually, but I felt that very drawn to this older culture and older people and the traditions. And I felt that the modern culture was, I don't know, it was kind of this Hello Kitty culture, right? You know?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of materialistic and shallow.
Yeah, it was very, well, Osaka was very businesslike. It did a lot of work in Osaka, and Kyoto was a little bit too, we're Kyoto, you know, you have to kind of be cultured enough. And I didn't like that too much either. So I didn't like being overly kind of like pragmatic and businesslike like Osaka, and I really didn't like the Kyoto. I mean, I loved them. I loved my 2 or 3 years in Japan, but I was ready to move on somehow, right? I mean, just, you know, Japan's intense. So I wanted to move on to something else. So that's when I got the idea to go back to Sogenji and try a year. Like, that would be my experience.
So you were supposed to have gone to India at this point, but you said, no, I'm going to go to Sogenji, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I met a lot of people coming back from India to teach English in Japan. And because I'd done the Aikido, I compared myself, and none of them seemed very healthy compared to me. at least how I felt, right? Coming back from India, I felt a little bit, you know, I don't know, seemed a little romantic, seemed a little more like...
Spacey?
Yeah, a little hippie, you know. It wasn't solving my problem. I came from an upper middle class, you could call it upper middle class suburban family. And, you know, our neurosis, I didn't see that India was just going to be more like another Grateful Dead concert. It wasn't going to be this... Japan seemed to have this modern and this old, like, accessible. And I didn't want to give up the modern totally. I didn't think my true nature was completely medieval, right? Or, you know, and I wasn't like the Himalayas. Yeah, I didn't have the vision yet to go to India. I later would, but I didn't have it yet.
So did you just show up at Sogenji or did you contact them first? What were the logistics of that?
My friend, Peter, who I lived with, he heard about my experience and he had lots of guts and he just went there. He had actually gone to the gate of Myoshinji and said, I want to be a monk. And they'd sent him up to Kamioka. Is that the name of it? Above Arashiyama, to a temple there where he got bored. And so he and I met teaching English and we got a room together, but he wanted to too. We had read The Empty Mirror. I don't know if that book rings a bell, but we had read that and some Deshimaru Tanden stuff. And we were kind of practicing every day together and we're both kind of into Zen. So he went first.
To Sogenji.
He went first to Sogenji, right? And I visited him there.
When you say you heard about your experience, were you talking about the fact that you were visiting that park and you heard the people speaking English and stuff like that?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I had already visited a temple and but he had heard about that there were foreigners there and apparently, you know, the Zen master had a good reputation. Mm-hmm. Through the Hanazono, he knew some people at the Hanazono Institute in Kyoto as well. Mm-hmm. So anyways, Harada Roshi already was supposed to be a young, interesting Roshi. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he went down there. Mm-hmm.
And did you keep in touch with your friend? Did he give you reports?
Sure. I mean, that was my link. That was how I was going to get in. So I would go for a day and then a week and then a session. You know, that's how I found my way in.
Was that your first session?
Excuse me?
Was your first session there at Sogenji?
It was 1987. Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was that intense for you?
That was back then. We did everything on the ground, meals, lectures, you know, and you, everything, there was nothing, there was no benches at that time. Yeah, it was like 17 hours with your legs crossed and lots of keisaku, like brutal keisaku. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had huge welts on my shoulders and, you know, we weren't too many people. But, you know, it was a chance to give all my energy to something. And I trusted something, too. So at the end of it, you know, I was kind of like, okay, you know, now I know what that is.
But did you have to? How did it work? Was there a fee to participate, or was it you could just come and participate if you wanted to?
I think at that time they worked quite intuitively. I think they could see who was sincere. The initial rule, and I think it stayed a long time, was if you come, you come for a year, and at least a year. But I think because I had a friend and it was obvious that I was sincere and I kind of fit the mold, right? I was 24 years old, you know, kind of a young guy who was saying hi a lot, you know, because I didn't know any other words, how to speak too much. So, and then the Roshi after the session said, you come for Rohatsu. And I'm like, this guy is such a fanatic. Mm-hmm. And then I came for Rohatsu. So 2 weeks later.
Could you talk about, what it was like meeting the Roshi? What were your first impressions of him? Harada Roshi, for, you know, those who are listening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was, I think he was 45, 46 years old when I first met him. Mm-hmm. And You know, what I liked about him was I didn't feel that he was a super nice, like Krishnamurti or like super spiritually kind of glowing guy. He seemed to me like a lieutenant in the military, like just like you want basic training. He's your boss. You know, that's how he looked to me, like a linebacker. Right at that time, he was doing samu, like work in the temple every day with the monks, and he was so strong and so fast, and he was just a ball of monk, you know, power monk. He was just, and I thought, yeah, that's what I want. Just a stud, you know, a samurai stud for a year. That would be fine with me. Then I won't get emotionally involved with someone like that. So that's my very first impression was, you know, he's very, seemed clear, but, you know, every day you could see him out there working, and then every day he looks like he worked, you know, he's got that energy of an incredibly hardworking person.
And is it Chi-san who kind of is right-hand woman, right?
Right, right.
Was she there at that point?
Yep, sure.
Yeah.
She kind of seduced me in, of course, in her own way. She was very accessible, very knowledgeable about the tradition. And she also, you know, had lived outside a monastery for 10 years. So she was kind of the link to make this thing possible.
What do you mean by that, lived outside?
She had gone to Shofukuji.
And studied
with Yamada Mumon Roshi.
And, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and studied with him for many years, and also studied pottery with some of the great potters in the area there, in the Kansai area. And she, the Roshi asked her to come with her. It was sort of Mumon Roshi's idea that both of them go to Sogenji and make a place for people that couldn't study at Shofukuji, which were foreigners, older people,
women,
and women, right? And men could study there. Some did, but it was tough. You know, I think you had to learn the language. You had to put up with a lot of cultural stuff too. So I think Mumon Roshi saw that people needed a place that had a different structure, and that was the mission of Shoto Harada. And
interesting. So Shoto Harada, he was basically there at his teacher's request. Like, that's what generated that whole interesting. I didn't know that.
Both of them.
And so when you started practicing there at Sogenji, you'd already had some taste of Zen at that point. I mean, how did your experience of Zen change when you're practicing there? Was it more of the same, or did it kind of kick into a different gear? What was that like for you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this interview is bringing up kind of what all happened back then, because again, nobody was asking me about my experience back then. And I don't think I was interested in writing it. There was no Zen book culture to imagine myself being somehow part of. I don't know exactly. I just kind of was in the flow, and I went to the Rohatsu, and I think, you know, that was when something kind of shifted on another level, because the very last night, I mean, it was so difficult, and, you know, trying not to lay down, and it was like a ridiculous game for me. I didn't have any real energy, but something at some point in the middle of the night, when we're in the Zendo till about 11:30 at night, or I don't know, maybe it was 10:30, but I was hanging there, you know, all my energy is just stuck in this line, like sitting like a coat in a hanger, on a hanger, and just staring at the ground. And at some point I gave up trying, and some sort of new power kind of took over and really flushed out every tension and every need for thought, and just a new lightness was there. And all of a sudden my mind was going wherever I looked. I kind of had to keep pulling it back to myself. I wasn't used to this feeling of my mind being able to go wherever I looked. And I thought it was interesting. I didn't know what I was experiencing, but something inside me was very content. You know, I wasn't really there for, but then right after that, we had this big, a mochi and bean dish in the Zendo, you know, just before Yaza. And they kind of had me help dish it out. And I got kind of confused about like carrying this pot around and dishing out this, because I was just barely there, but Chisan got me involved. And, you know, I went to Sansen with the Roshi at 2 or 4 in the morning or wherever. And both of us were kind of, I don't know, he kind of gave up on me somewhere at that session. He was very strict at that time. He was just, he didn't give me too much. I don't think he opened his eyes when I went into Dogusan that day. But I didn't care. You know, I felt.
What do you mean by he gave up? Gave up on you?
I felt free to walk out of there like a free man. I can come back or I can go. So that was great. And then I went home for the first time in 2.5 years. And my brother died during that time. And I checked it out and decided to go back to Japan. And I figured I'd go back to Sogenji in the springtime when it was warmer. Mm-hmm. But then I went back on February 1st. Mm-hmm. That's Chisan's very seductive. She just got her voice on the phone, and I felt like, God damn it, someone's letting me come. I'm going to come, you know? So I went to January Sesshin, and I moved in 5 days after Sesshin and stayed for the next, I don't know, 15 years around there.
Mm-hmm. Did the Roshi give you any formal practice when you first started working with him, or like did he work on your breath with you?
Yes. It was all about Susokan, sure. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, he only talked to me in Japanese, and it was very early on he stopped letting me have translation. I didn't realize at the time that he had kind of an idea for me to learn Japanese. But of course, at the beginning, I could understand 20% of what he was saying. But it didn't really matter to me. It was so damned honest, everything. I had never felt like I was doing honest work. And I kept asking myself the question, like, where's this going? It doesn't matter. You're doing honest work. Like, you get food and a place to stay, and you get to just work and meditate and learn this. So just go for it. And that's what I did. And at some point, after about 3 months of lots of keisaku and, you know, dokusan with the Roshi, I was suddenly sitting straight, and I don't know exactly how that happened, but all the monks came up to me and shook my hand when they saw that my posture, I was sitting straight, and I got hit quite a bit less. That was after about 3 or 4 months living in the monastery.
Would you say any of kind of the training, not by the Roshi, but by kind of the senior monks, what do you think it ever kind of crossed the line into hazing at all? Was there, or was it all kind of seem like grandmotherly love type of motivation?
You know, some very serious Japanese monks came down to work with us. And there was also an American guy there. I often tell the story about Daijo. He's the American guy. He was at Daitokuji from
I met him. Yeah, I actually met him.
Mm-hmm. And he used to hit very hard, but he hit very well. And I would have these blue marks, and I asked him why he hit me so often. And he said, "You have a great back." And I was like, okay. You know, I got hit one morning, like 88 times, you know, before 11 a.m., you know, and I got fed up that morning. But I couldn't, you know, I didn't have energy to keep my eyes open or my back straight. And there was a bunch of young samurais we were all just pounding each other, and it was sort of okay. You know, I mean, what's behind it? That's the beauty of the Japanese form. Mm-hmm. You know, you do your job, and what's behind it, you know, there can be a clean exchange in the keisaku, no matter what state, what I'm thinking about or what he's thinking about, you know, with the bow, it's an opportunity to not haze, you know, it's an opportunity to do it right. And I did feel, of course, that they were hard on me, and and the Roshi sometimes felt sorry for me, but then he was later much worse, you know. People were hard on me, but I think that has something to do with the situation I got myself into, whatever. I don't you know, I work with a lot of teenagers. I mean, bullying is not only about the poor person who gets bullied, right? There is some reason why a person gets bullied. And so I was a foreigner. I got bullied in Aikido as well, right? They loved to throw me around. But I didn't care because that's not the part I was looking at. I saw the sincerity. I saw that the Japanese actually wanted me to taste some of their Japanese-ness and their chi, right? Their energy. Mm. They were not only, they were inviting me into their club in their own funny way, but sure, there's an initiation process that feels a lot like hazing, sure.
So eventually the Roshi gave you mu, right?
Yeah, that was strange because Susokan was so difficult for me, but then he gave me a Dharma name. Mm-hmm. Which is Do-Yu, but it was a different one than I have now, but I can explain that if you're interested. But when I got the Dharma name, he put Mu on the, he actually at that time drew a calligraphy and sewed himself the silk cloth on the back of the Rakusu.
So you did Jukai.
It was Mu, right? And and then he gave me the Mu koan, right? And that was great. I could really... I had often heard from different people and have still heard in the meantime that some people can concentrate much better on mu or a koan than they can on the breath. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those. It was much easier for me to go to hold that space in concentration with mu than it was with the Susokan. So that was another level of energetic practice for me. Move things along.
Yeah. So, was it frustrating for you at all, or were you just kind of all into the energetic aspect of it?
I mean, I did Mu, I think, for 5 years. I mean, it's a lot of life happened. I got ordained. I went through quite a bit with Mu, with the Roshi. But he had already kind of told me by that time that he really wanted me to one day also be in, you know, continue Zen in America and be a part of that. So there was sort of I felt there was a reason he didn't move me along really fast. He really wanted me to be part of something. And I wasn't in a big hurry anyways, you know, with that. I don't know why it stayed so interesting. You know, it really was interesting with the training and the life itself. So I wasn't, frankly, I just didn't find that the koan curriculum was really where my heart was at with being in the temple. I liked this bodhisattva aspect and working with the people and, you know, helping or being a part of this philosophy that the Roshi was talking about in Taisho, right? But I can't say that the mu itself was, I'm sure I was ambitious as anybody. But when other people were maybe passing it faster, I didn't feel, I felt I had my path to go. I guess I feel that's something I can do. I didn't feel I had to compare myself with others or think too much about how great it's going to be when I pass Mu or something.
I mean, how about just like even laying aside, you know, ambition or, you know, gaining mind, like just mechanically doing Mu, was that hard? Was that frustrating? Was that difficult for you? You know, being, you know, rejected in Dokusan, what was that experience like, you know? Or were you just kind of in the flow and didn't even think about it on those levels at all?
Well, of course, you know, he moved me to head monk fairly earlier, assistant head monk, you know, Jiki, Jiki, and then I was head monk actually while I was still doing Mu once in a while and leading sutras. I mean, the sutras, leading the sutra hall, leading ceremonies. I mean, that was tough. It was a lot to learn in my, you know, in Japanese but the Mu itself, you know, was basically the way we learned it, you know, was to go in, you know, Joshua Shochinamini Soto, you know, your forehead's on the ground.
Oh, you said it in Japanese.
Right. You know, I was reciting it, you know, with your forehead touching the ground after numerous prostrations till you get in and, you know, with all the different weather situations. And, you know, so there were these moments, right, where you you just release your mu, right? And the Roshi observes you, your shout, right? And, you know, it can be longer, shorter, powerful, or weaker. And, or he can see in your eyes, you know, he's gave a million interviews. He knows where you're at when he feels energy, and he knows where he wants you to go with it. If he was cultivating me very strongly to be Jikijitsu, to be head monk, and he wanted me to have a very strong Tanden, I don't think he taught everybody the same way. But he really went for it with me for this Tanden and this strong expression without fear and doubt and expansion, you know, and just watching that process with me of just energetically getting more and more confident and full, right, in my being with this energy, right, just being initiated into this field of Zen. I don't know if that's the only Zen, but that was the Zen as I knew it. And it was okay for me. You know, I was going with the Roshi because I got to be his driver. So I had a special relationship to him. I think I lost you, Barry. I hope you're still here. I don't see you anymore.
Hi, I'm not sure what happened. Yep.
Yeah. So I was his driver quite a bit in these early years. So I did have a special relationship with him and had a lot of opportunity to be with him and accompany him for a lot of sutra reading or zazenkais and stuff like that. So there was a lot of, I had a kind of a Zen family, you could say. I felt I belonged and I doing a good job in the family business, you could say, you know, just doing my role was very fulfilling. You know, there was that emotional quality with Chison as well as Roshi that I had mentors looking out for me and just go for it. I had a lot of trust in those two people.
So could you talk a little bit? So eventually he moved you on from Mu. Could you talk a little bit about that process and what was going on there?
Yeah, I mean, he was never very, he never gave you that special moment. There was a time when, I mean, I remember it very well when, you know, the bottom sort of fell out and I could really feel, kind of an endless connection, below me. And he saw that and, you know, he just rejected me, you know, the better I felt, the more clear I felt, the more he would reject and kind of close down my sense of warm feeling with him. But somehow, you know, my energy was rolling well enough. And then, of course, he reaches out his hand and says, put Mu in my hand, or, you know, what's the consciousness of Mu? And you kind of like... I just want to shout, you know, I'm here, you know, And so, you know, that's the invitation for the magnets of the intellect to start coming back in. And of course it was kind of terrible for quite a few weeks, kind of coming out of this absolute, you know, there was nothing to do but be centered and let it fly, you know, kind of experience of building up your Tanden and then kind of realizing you've been working on a koan and you've been working on this place that's there to look, to see from, not just something to see from in that moment of being with the Roshi. So yeah, it wasn't easy for me, and it wasn't initially interesting for me either, frankly. I don't know. I didn't have that. Yeah, I wouldn't say I didn't have it. I didn't have a great ambition or kind of that it didn't catch my intellect where right at the base, you know, initially there were a few koans and backup poems that were interesting, but it was such damn hard work, you know, to stay focused enough to really get through the koan in Japanese. I would look up all the kanjis, you know, he would give it to me in writing, the Roshi would, and then write in Romaji the koans, so I could find them up. But I looked up, and if I would look them up, I would become much more clear about the meaning of the koan. I looked up the kanjis, you know, I got a dictionary. And but, you know, it was a lot of study, and God, you know, we were working like crazy. I was head monk and there were ceremonies and yaza and, I mean, you don't have that much time to go off and look up kanjis and look up, you know, poems and stuff. So I felt, you know, I felt sure a little bit pulled, you know, towards sometimes studying when I didn't feel like it. Put it that way. It was hard work.
So resolving Mu, like looking back on it, would you say it was more like an energy attunement? Or do you think there was a kind of a prajna wisdom element to it as well? Like what do you think the Roshi's criteria was? And what did he want to see in you to move you past Mu? Like what was actually going on there, do you think? You understand the question? Am I being
No. Well, I think it's I think it's the question, you know, I think that's the best question. How does that really work? And I think what he saw in me anyways, was that the mix of the vow, bodhisattva vow, you know, in other words, that my anger issue with him, whatever that was, you know, projections or whatever, because he was pretty hard on me. And I sometimes have very strong emotional reactions to it or to other people in the Sangha. At some point, something stabilized where I wasn't getting moved around by other people in a leadership position. And then he asked me to go to America and lead my own retreat in 1993, I think. Just after ordaining, and that was terrible. It's a long story, but when I finally got through that and I came back from leading that retreat, he's told me I found my vow, and I was somehow very relaxed after having my Zen practice belong in the context of working with Americans. I had led a retreat for 5 days at Cloud Mountain up in Castle Rock.
I was gonna say, did you guys have Wibbly Island at that point?
No, not yet. Nothing about Wibbly. I think the land had been purchased, but there was nothing on it, and I didn't go there until 1996. 95 or 96.
Because I remember when I interviewed Corey, the kind of his introduction to Zen was going to, I would say it wrong, is it Whidbey Island? Whidbey?
Correct.
He went to the, you know, the, I don't know if you can call it monastery, but the practice place there. And you were kind of the first Zen guy he met, I think.
Right.
So you must have been, so that was built and you were living there and you were the head monk there for a while, right?
Correct. Yeah. Right. The Roshi, he had me come over and translate for him a couple of times and meet the people on Whidbey Island. And then he sent me over for a year to live in a an Airstream trailer with a porta potty and to kind of live on the land. And I think I would just take my mokugyo and my bell around to everybody's house who was sitting with the Roshi. And in the whole Northwest area, I was just a traveling salesman Zen guy for a couple of years, and then we built the place there. So the Roshi asked me to go to Whidbey at some point after about 10 years.
And that was 10 years into your practice,
right?
And you stayed there for 15 years, so that means you went back to Sogenji.
I was going Minnesota. Back and forth then for 5 or 6 years.
Did you enjoy kind of being out there in the outpost, or was it frustrating for you, or you just kind of taking it as it came, not really trying to judge it, or what was that
I loved it. No, I was ready to test it, you know. I mean, as much as I did like my training at Sogenji, and I was kind of wondering what the next thing was. I was sure kind of wondering if one day I'd just get a temple on the coast of Japan or what was kind of really going to happen. And then he sent me. It was kind of a sudden surprise. And no, I was totally up for it. I realized Americans were so hungry for it, and there was a lot of respect, and there was a group there established in Seattle. So every Monday night I would drive into Seattle, and people would put me up everywhere. And it was, yeah, it was kind of a, I could be kind of a spark plug to keep the Sangha kind of going. It was a good role for me. I had a lot of energy at that time.
So what led you to leaving Sogenji? It seems like you were pretty, it was kind of your life at that point. What was the transition there?
Well, once we'd be built up to a certain level where we could have the Roshi for Sesshin every year, the Roshi had promised to come and live in America to the people. That's where a lot of the money donated came to build a $2 million place, right? And, you know, the Japanese can promise things and not do them differently than we can, you know, so he meant it in a certain way, but what he really wanted was that Chisan and I would one day take this place and he would kind of guide it from a distance. So he would be there, but like he is now, but not there. And we didn't know that. And maybe he didn't either. But I kind of developed my, I always describe it as my American cells had become so Japanese, you know, eating Japanese food and being in Japan and just getting so concentrated, you know, and so kind of compact. And once I was on Whidbey Island with the raccoons and the eagles and the deer and the porta potty, you know, I just started loosening up a little bit. And I would go back to Sogenji and I couldn't find the same feeling with the Roshi. We kind of started to grow apart in a certain way. It's like a relationship that started to grow a little bit apart. And then, of course, I was looking for my love and my place more on Whidbey, you know, because I was there more. And I didn't feel I didn't feel the concept was clear enough for me. I felt like no one, they didn't have my back in the way I felt I wanted it. And so I wanted to go on pilgrimage. I didn't say, hey, I'm leaving. I was like, God, it's I'm getting overwhelmed here. You know, I mean, I don't. And then I had an issue with the Roshi about marriage, because I had always assumed that Japanese monks can marry. So he's not going to get in my way. But the issue finally kind of hit the climax. And he told me, frankly, that I should never get married. Which I found at 40 years old, I was turning into being 40 years old. I found something inside me said, I don't feel like being told whether I'll ever get married or not. I want to ask this question. So I need to get away for a while. That was the initial kind of doubt that I felt. You know, I felt.
I think you're the fourth person I talked to who's, them leaving Sogenji and working with the Roshi was kind of precipitated by the marriage or having a baby element. That seems to be a pattern.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, they had an idea about it. I always thought that Whidbey should be a center, you know, not a monastery, because I understood the clerical connotations. You know, I talked to many pastors on the island, and but you know, that's, it's kind of an old story that looking back, you know, you get what you get. You know, the Roshi is an amazing kind of guy in a very feudal tradition in many ways, and I was raised very modern, so I had to acknowledge that part of myself that's not feudal. And I didn't want it to be, you know, as again, like a lot of my things in my life, I didn't leave. I kept my robes, and he let me keep my robes. And I went to India and went to Mother Teresa's place and met the monks there, thought about being a monk there, went to other ashrams and, you know, Ramakrishna. I checked out a lot of staying within religion, you know, I wasn't sure what else also I could do, right? So I was still checking it out, for, I think in my mind, my heart, for years, right? Whether I really one day might go back or something like that, right? But
so you never formally said, like, I'm leaving. You're, it was more, I'm taking a break and I want to travel around type of thing.
Wish it could sound like that. No, it was a long, painful process. He didn't want me to leave, and was very, it was jagged. You know, he had to communicate it like a Japanese, like, please don't leave. But the way he communicated that was more like, you're such an idiot, you can't leave. And it's like, well, no, I can leave. You know, like, you know, that little rebellious part had to, you know, didn't like that. And the first time I ever really said no, right? Mm-hmm. It's just such a weird thing. I never said no. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't know no. You know, so I couldn't say totally no, but this idea of the pilgrimage, and then he supported that. He supported, but said, come back to the Soto, come back to the male monastery. Mm-hmm. And he wanted me to train there to get out of this idea that some of those nice women I met in America, get them all out of my system and stay in Japan for, I don't know. But one of the Roshi's monks told me, you think you're going to go there for 3 years, 1 year, 3 years. He said, no, the Roshi keeps you in there as long as he wants to. Once you're in, he's really your boss, and you're in that Japanese system. And I thought, no, I have to go away first. I can't go to a Soto and in this, with this question, right? I'll go crazy. So that's why I went to India and checked it out.
Yeah. So when you were in India, what did you like about it, and what did you kind of miss from Zen, would you say?
That's an interesting question. I was wearing black and dark blue all the time, and everyone else was wearing like orange and yellow and blue, you know, green and nice colors. I mean, that was really strange in India for me, like starting to wear different colors. I remember that very well. And but I went to Tiruvannamalai, which is kind of a meditation mecca, right, where Ramana Maharshi was for 50 years. And it's just a place where a lot of people end up who did a lot of years of practice in India or other places in the world. It's kind of a mature spiritual practitioner's mecca. And I didn't know that that's exactly where I was going, but I was drawn there. And I did meet some good spiritual teachers there. I met lots of them. I met Sumedho, Ajahn Sumedho, the head of the London. He was there, and I had tea with him and told him my story. And I was pretty wound up at the time, and he gave me some advice. I mean, I talked to a lot of people. It was a good place to go, kind of a neutral place with a lot of traditions and a lot of sense of guys who had left Ama, you know, after many, many years, 20 years. So, I mean, I met very interesting people and could sort of sort through things. And then in Calcutta was fantastic. I loved working the nuns and monks there. I lived with the monks. They invited me to stay and teach meditation. But I couldn't handle the herbs and spices of and the air probably of Calcutta. I got very sick. And that's when I decided to travel on.
Where did you go from there?
I went to Nepal, went to the mountains and walked around Annapurna, and that was awesome, and got healthy, and decided to go back to Germany for a month.
How were you funding this? Because, I mean, you just could come 15 years as a penniless monk, you know.
That's a great question, too. So your second best question now. my grandmother had passed away and left me $10,000. And I had spent about five of it on Whidbey Island over two or three or four years. So I had like $4,500 left. And I knew if I didn't use it now, I would never go. So that was my way. I had $3,000. After the plane ticket, I had $3,000. And a ticket for a year to India.
So when you're visiting all these different practice centers, do you feel they were essentially doing the same practice you had been doing on Whidbey Island, or do you think it was kind of a different modality? I mean, obviously, like, you know, the language, you know, the way it's characterized is different. And obviously, your stream of Rinzai Zen is very energy focused and, somatic and so forth. But do you think it was the same underlying wisdom at all the different places, or do you think Zen was kind of going for something different?
No, it's the same in one way. Just the emphasis, of course, is different. I think in India, you encounter the Jhani traditions, right? The who am I, or the not this, not that, Advaita philosophy. And, it's a subtle mental energy that's Indian based, but yeah, different, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody, you're not shouting moo in those places.
Right.
And also devotion, right? Mm-hmm. Devotion. I didn't realize how devoted I was, but it had a very, kind of this holeless flute feeling to my devotion, right? There was no expanding flower bush feeling with my feeling of devotion in Zen. It felt like, do what the Roshi says, that's your devotion, and then serve like a motherfucker. Oh, sorry.
Don't.
Serve, and be there for others. And, I liked that. But somehow I got to the point where I needed this sense of a flower in my heart too. And that's what I loved about India. There was this, what we often think, we don't like even the word devotion, but there was this, in German it's Hingabe, this absolute kind of, this heart directing towards your teacher, towards your other people, which sometimes to me, was a little bit gooey. But it was sometimes so soft and nice. It was so friendly, kind of. I just liked that, right? The singing of the bhajans. And it was also very restful, just like rhythm. I danced only twice in my Zen career, and both times I got scolded afterwards.
Yeah. So, it's funny. When you're describing that, it kind of reminds me a little bit, not that I have had tons of interaction with it, but like Chinese Buddhism seems to have a little bit more of that soft kind of vibe that you're describing, as opposed to Japanese Buddhism that I've encountered. I've been to legit Chinese monasteries, and there's definitely a devotional, soft, almost a sweet vibe to it that I've never really encountered in Japanese Zen at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I got it in spades also in Calcutta with Mother Teresa. I mean, they're so in love with Jesus, the nuns there. I mean, I was just like, lucky guy. I was in a room with 60 nuns singing, and it's like, wow, like that's a vibration. It's like, got goosebumps. That was special. So sure, you find other ways to be completely devoted, and they were channels I had not opened within myself. It wasn't as accessible, but it was accessible. In other words, I felt very much that I belonged there, but I felt there were lots of qualities to cultivate that I could do outside of my tradition that interested me. Yeah.
So what can you describe kind of like the formal break from Sogenji and the Roshi, how that came about? Because at this point, it seemed like it was informal, and with the kind of the implicit idea you were coming back. So what transpired there?
Well, because I didn't come back at this deadline for the Sodo. And then I think a session came with the Roshi in Switzerland. And I went down for the one session I did with him over here in Europe. And I we didn't have a click, we didn't have, it was okay, it was okay. But, he immediately put me one cushion lower on the ton because I had left, than someone else, and this hierarchical thing. And I was like, you think I care about that? Like where I sit. And I had kind of already let go of a lot of those things in a few months. And, I guess he was just, he didn't have a great vocabulary for how to draw me in. And we it usually takes a session, the guy works so hard, he's tired, and then he gets a session energy. And at the end, he's super nice to me. But boy, I just wanted to get out of there. I really didn't have any, and I said goodbye. And then I went to another workshop in Palermo down in Sicily, and saw him again with my new boss, and tried to integrate it. I started doing social work, but I lived in a 300-year-old mill with a beautiful creek and a garden, and we kind of built up I used a lot of my energy with this woman to kind of build up this social workplace we did, working with youth in this beautiful old mill in the countryside. And I think that's where I was still kind of sitting on the fence, kind of doing social work, thinking I'm doing the Roshi's work. And then I think I had to move out of there. I had to get my own apartment. And I think that was where I had kind of an emotional breakdown and had to kind of, give up the temple idea. I had to get an apartment. You know, I had to start getting insurances. I had to start getting all kinds of things that were not in limbo anymore. Like I had to make that commitment. And then there was just no space for thinking about going back one day or something, right? There was nothing I was going to learn back in that tradition to help me deal with, you know, timing my laundromat use or whatever, you know, all the things you figure out when you first live by yourself. I was like 46, 47 years old. I hadn't lived by myself since I was in college, you know, so.
So it sounds like it more fizzled out versus there was a meeting where you said, okay, I'm not coming back, or it seems like it just kind of more fizzled out then?
Well, I don't know. You know, when I just saw the Roshi a couple of weeks ago, I think what's still there is still there. I think I could go back tomorrow if I want to go back into that, but I'm married now. But that part of me is kind of alive, but I'm not in the form. So yeah. I can't really say that it fizzled. I would say that.
No, I meant not your Zen practice. I meant more your formal relationship with the Roshi and the fact that you were planning to come back. Was there ever that discussion, or was it more just, it kind of just didn't happen?
No, there's no fizzling. Then it just cutting, right? There's cutting and dealing with it.
So you told him that you weren't coming back then?
No, he just... I went back to say hello once in a while. He shut the door in my face a couple of times and just wouldn't see me. So
I see.
That was kind of a clear message that I hadn't kept. I wrote him many letters, but never received anything back. So it was obvious that he had a certain purpose for giving me a lot of attention. And I think he was very hurt that I left, and took quite a while to kind of find a way to just kind of go forward. Because they didn't really have a plan B for Whidbey Island. I was supposed to kind of do that. And so I think he's, you know, it's like, if you're not going to do that, what are you doing here? You know, sort of that's the feeling I got. But it became beautiful again. You know, I got a little older. He got a little older. And when I saw him, we had a nice moment. So, I hope I see him again.
Yeah. So you were in Europe working as a social worker. How did you get into the shiatsu and massage and body work and stuff like that? Is your wife European? Like, what are you doing in Europe? Like, how did you wind up in Europe?
Right. Well, like I said, I hooked on to a social work place. And I mean, I just started doing stuff with kids, traveling with kids, playing sports with kids, baseball, basketball, anything I could. I developed a basketball pedagogic, right? I developed whatever I could. I didn't do any kind of schooling for that. But I kind of have a knack with kids, you could say. Or maybe I think I do, but... It went well, you know, with the kids. We worked through a lot. We had very successful business. We became like 15 workers, and I was the first worker there. But there was also kind of a fallout because we were kind of working as a team, she, the boss and I. But then she really took over and became the boss, and she kind of turns out also she's kind of an old-fashioned person with a very hierarchical concept and was a very matriarchal figure. And I kind of went lower and lower on the hierarchy. I didn't like that too much, but I got a shiatsu training and kind of had a room, and I worked with my clients and developed, you know, I wasn't good at the beginning, so it took time and I had a lot of work. I had like lots and lots of people. So I you know, I did a lot of Qigong and Shiatsu with people at the center, and I stayed there after I moved out as well. And then I lived 4.5 years in my own place. And then at my Shiatsu schools, at a gathering, like I said, I had told you, I think I met my wife, hit her with the Keisaku. And then we had a 4 year, she lives in Ulm, which is 200.
Is she German?
Excuse me?
Is she German?
She is. She's German. And then, but she's lived all over. She lived in San Diego. She's a surfer. Mm-hmm. She lived in South America. She lived in Costa Rica. She's lived in Hawaii. She's Australia. She's a traveler too, and had some ways a similar story with me, in some ways. So we kind of found each other in that, and lived together, I think now 10 years or so. And, and got married 2 years ago. With COVID, it was like there were so many restrictions that we could imagine organizing a party. So we did. We had a small wedding and wonderful. Yeah, I'm very happy.
Great. Cool. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you about your journey. If someone wanted to reach out to you for any reason, what would be kind of the best way to do that? Do you want me to put an email in the description?
Very nice. It's markalvin.com, right?
Oh, yeah, your website. Right?
So I have a website there, and I have an English. You have to look in the corner, but it goes in English too. So. Very welcome. Sure.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Barry. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Encounter you.